Professor Fernbach reminds me that the two most important events today are Dean Graham's visit and what happened last night. Virginia won and is now headed for the final four.
One might throw in good Fridays, and perhaps one doesn't do that. How big is it? 12-3.
We're very pleased that Patricia Graham, Dean of the School of Education, could be with us today. Like all good Americans who graduate to Cambridge or Charlottesville, she began in the Midwest, born in Lafayette, Indiana. Got her bachelor's and master's degrees from Purdue and her PhD from Columbia. She's had numerous honorary degrees, Indiana, Beloit, Clark, Suffolk University. Her teaching career brought her close to us in that she taught high school in Norfolk and then New York City, then went on to become professor of history of education at Barnard College and Columbia Teachers College. She went to Cambridge and became dean and then vice president of Radcliffe College. Became professor, then Warren professor, and then dean of the Graduate School of Education at Harvard. She had a period of government service as director of the National Institute of Education in Washington. She's the author of a number of books, Progressive Education from Arcady to Academe, and Community and Class in American Education. She's on a number of boards. It seems to me every time I read one of them, Bob O'Neill must be on the same board, such as Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, the Testing Service, and others. She has been president of the National Educational Association. It seems entirely fitting that with the breadth of her experience and her scholarly and leadership contributions that we should turn to her for some light on the question of the presidency in education.
Thank you very much. You know, it's a great treat for me to be back in Charlottesville, because I was first here in Charlottesville in 1956, about this time of year, when it was also raining, and I was absolutely scared to death, because I brought with me a group of high school seniors who were in a class that I was teaching for a play acting contest, one-act play contest, that was being held here at the University of Virginia. And these youngsters were from the Dismal Swamp, and none of them had even been as far as Norfolk, which is only about 15 miles away. And here I was 20 years old. I was pregnant. I'd been married for a year and a half. And I had these 9 outrageous teenagers on my hands who'd never been away from home overnight before. And we stayed in a lovely hotel in downtown Charlottesville, and I had the 2 girls in my room, and I kept them absolutely in my sphere of vision the entire time. And the boys were in the next room. And the happy event for us was that this group of kids who were in probably, this is of course before desegregation, they were all white, were the most absolutely poverty-stricken. They'd never been out of the Dismal Swamp before. They'd never seen a college campus. They'd never seen the lawn. They didn't know what the lawn was. By some fluke, we had happened to win in our district in Virginia Beach and had come to the state finals. And our school had been built with Sears Roebuck blueprints, because the school was too poor to have an architect, and Sears Roebuck said you should have a trophy case in your school. And in 1955, when I started teaching in the school, there was one trophy in the school, the 1927 third place track trophy. And the consequence of our visit to Charlottesville in the spring of 56 with this group for the one act play contest, we brought back the second place state trophy in play acting. So this community has great meaning for me. I was then fired 6 weeks later because, as a pregnant married woman, I was a bad influence on the morale of the school. I might give them ideas, not that they didn't already have those ideas. And that concluded my teaching at Deep Creek High School. But I remember Charlottesville vividly and how important it was to these young people. I thought what I might do for a bit this morning is talk about what I see as the issues for the President of the United States in relation to education within the United States. And I want to focus on what some issues seem to me to be for the President in education, focus on pre-collegiate education. It's very fashionable in colleges and universities where I spend most of my time, since that's my employer, to talk about what the President should do about higher education. But I'd like to talk today about pre-collegiate education, that is, of little children, because I think that in this country the needs there are the greatest. That is, the most serious problems of education in this country that the President needs to address are in education below the college level. And secondly, I would argue that the needs below the college level are more responsive to federal concerns. Higher education in the United States is internationally much more highly regarded than elementary secondary. Outside the United States, lots of people think we have a fairly good higher educational system. We may also recognize that it needs improvement. I would argue, too, that some of the most significant problems of higher education are debates within academia about curricular diversity or curricular cohesiveness. And it's not clear to me that those are debates in which the President of the United States or the federal government apparatus ought to play a large role. And I would argue, secondly, that another area of important debate in higher education in the United States is over instruction in or modeling of ethical behavior. And that, given our recent history, does not seem to me to be amenable to federal action either. So that I would say that the two absolutely key issues in higher education, namely quality and content of instruction and the whole question about how do we make our young people more ethical through instruction or through example, neither of those is amenable to federal intervention. Now, somebody wise will say, what about student aid? Of course I think student aid is a problem, and I think that the poor who are trying to go to college and who are now having to take loans in order to go to college instead of having more grant aid that was previously the case, of course that's a serious problem. But that is not a complex problem to analyze. That is only a complex problem for which to get money. And I would observe, and I say this coming from a very high tuition institution, but as a graduate of some low tuition institutions, that there need to be more incentives for able people to go to public institutions. And this is particularly true in my part of the country, in the Northeast, where public higher education has not achieved as much distinction as it has in places such as your university and in other parts of the world. So I think I want to make four points, about what seemed to me to be, given this preamble, what we might think about in terms of the President's role in education. Like many of my colleagues, I would argue first that the President's most vital role in education is his use of the bully pulpit. His use of the bully pulpit in support of education for everybody. Now, it's hard to imagine that there could be any more important mandate for the President of the United States than to convince the American public of the imperative nature of nurturing and enhancing the wit and the character of the young. Now, what is more important for our country than to nurture and to enhance the wit and the character of the young? And surely, that is a role of national need in which our educational system plays a role. Now, how might he do that? Well, certainly I would argue that greater financial support is needed for education. I would say that even more important than the financial support which is needed for education in this country, what is most important of all is developing the social and the political will in the United States that places a high priority for all of us upon educating the next generation well. We need to stress the positive benefits for the individual that comes with good education and the positive benefits for the society that comes with good education for everybody. You know, the motivating force to get better education for young people has typically been argued as being that of parents who want to see their children succeed. Let me tell you, that's too narrow a basis on which to think about this issue. It works quite well if you have upper income, well-motivated, well-educated parents who are concerned about their children and who move to a community of like-minded and like-placed people. But the problems of education in our country cannot be solved by resting on the parental cohort to look after junior. The educational problems in this country rest on all of us, whether we have children in school or whether we don't, who see that it is for our country's benefit as well as for the individual's benefit for those youngsters to be educated well. That means that we might want to take some quite unpopular stands. We might want, for example, I hate to say this after the Final Four, but it may be that in some communities we place less value on kids working part-time at a fast food restaurant so that they can make a lot of money, so that they can buy a lot of consumer goods, and we as a community place a higher value on youngsters staying home and doing their homework. We simply have not built a consensus in this country that says that learning for everybody is a good thing. We've built a consensus that says learning for some, namely our children, is important. But we haven't built a consensus that says that kind of learning for everybody is important. And I think that there the president's role of bully pulpit could be very effective to develop a collaborative support with state and local governments around these issues, as well as with private leadership for this priority. The point of education, after all, ought to be to maximize the talent that is widely distributed in the United States population, not to reinforce privilege as it currently exists. Many of our educational institutions are based on the premise of helping the bright, able, well-motivated do better, and not helping those who do not seem to be bright in a conventional way find the talents that exist within them and let those talents flourish. It seems to me that the goal has got to be to maximize the talent that is broadly distributed. Efforts to improve education for the American population, particularly for those in the U.S. population for whom educational achievement has been elusive in the past, would be both new in our history and necessary to support our present democracy and economy. My friends, some of whom are here who are interested in the history of education, I think, would agree that neither we in the United States nor any other industrialized, heterogeneous country has ever been good at educating the bottom, socioeconomically bottom third of the population. What we in the United States have been very good at is taking individual youngsters in that bottom third of the socioeconomic distribution who can adapt to the mores of the American educational system and helping that youngster flourish. We've been better than most countries at taking the individual child of poverty and helping that child flourish. But what we and all other countries have not been good at is taking that entire bottom third or bottom 40%. And that's what we've got to figure out how to do in the future. Our previous emphasis on the inadequacies of the educational system in the United States. And we've had lots of talk in the last, throughout our history, but particularly in the last 10 years. We've had lots of talk about how bad the American schools are. We have heard about how bad the schools are. We've heard about how bad the teachers are, how bad the administrators are. I would just observe that low pay and abominable working conditions for teachers, particularly those in schools serving the children of the poor, and a highly regulated environment for administrators that limits their autonomy and professional judgment, those all reinforce in educators' minds that American society does not take them or their work seriously. This is not a great inducement for many of them to do better. One of the great anomalies in American schools is that there is much greater regulation on the part of how teachers live their lives as teachers and how administrators live their lives on schools that are serving the children of the poor than they are on schools that are serving the children of the affluent. You think about a school like Phillips Academy in Andover, Phillips Exeter, or St. Paul's, or whatever your favorite very good, excellent independent school is, or whatever your favorite excellent suburban school system is. The regulation that teachers work under in those schools is much less than it is in an inner city school, and the regulations that affect administrators in those places is much less. The more regulated the environment, the fewer decisions that a teacher or an administrator can make about what to do professionally, the more constrained that person feels, and the less likely they are to be able to do a good job. And I believe that this is a part of the these kinds of regulatory issues and these kinds of critique issues are not issues that cost money, and they are issues on which the president could speak. I think the president, in his use of the bully pulpit, also needs to recognize that education is broader than schooling. School is a subset of education. Education can occur in a variety of settings. Schooling is narrower. And the federal government needs to be attentive to the other agencies that educate besides the schools. The schools remain primarily creatures of state and local government, but some of these other agencies are more amenable to national concerns. For example, the role of the federal government in regulating commercial and public television. Federal government, in my view, should support programming of educational value to children and adults. I very much regret, for example, President Reagan's failure to sign the Children's Television Act of 1988, despite bipartisan support in the Congress, including unanimous passage for the Senate. This was an act which would have mandated television stations to carry more programming that would be of educational benefit to children. That doesn't cost much money. That's an example of the national leadership that could enhance education. I think we also need to remember the role of the federal government's support of museums, children's museums, science museums, art museums, providing both enrichment and stimulus to the children's customary curriculum. Our federal government funds such at the moment through the Institute of Museum Services to a total of $22 million a year. Given our federal budget, that's not much. How many of us remember as small children going to our local public library? It was certainly in the West Lafayette, Indiana Public Library, as I made my way in the upstairs down, the children's books were upstairs, and as I made my way down the bookshelves upstairs, that I got acquainted with lots of things in the world that I got interested in, and yet most libraries are being starved for financial support, what usually means is that they have to close their doors, and typically they close their doors at hours that it would be easier for children to come, which is late afternoon or early evening. So it seems to me that federal government spends $137 million in the Department of Education library budgets. Again, not very much. So it seems to me that there are a number of ways in which the president himself can speak out effectively on education and use the regulatory mechanism to enhance issues for the benefit of children. Second point I'd like to make is that I think it seems to me that the administration has a role in enhancing the conditions of life for children so that they are more likely to benefit from education. That is, if you send a child to school who is hungry, who has not had books in his home, who is not thoroughly washed, who hasn't been immunized properly, the school is going to have a very hard time with that child. There are a great variety of federal programs right now, all of them outside the Department of Education, which address the needs of those children. One of the things that the administration could do would be to attend to and to, the favorite phrase these days, integrate services that would benefit these children. For example, Head Start, which is in the Department of Health and Human Services, is one of the few programs about which there is no doubt that it works. Head Start is the program for preschool children to help them get off to a good start in school, currently funded at $1.2 billion, yet it serves only 20% of the eligible children. The other way to say that, obviously, is that 80% of the children who could benefit from the Head Start services are not getting them. know, this is prevention. Prevention is a whale of a lot cheaper than fixing the disease once the disease is raging through you. But, you know, little children don't vote, and the advocacy groups, although they have been effective, have not been effective to get this the services to a higher fraction of children. Daycare, under a variety of administrative auspices, both federal and state, needs to be integrated. If there's one thing a child needs, it's a safe environment in which to spend the day. And if we would like those children's parents to be employed, there needs to be some safe place for that child to be. That a place that is not only safe, but also nurturing. Yet the variety of daycare arrangements are very scattered. Similarly, nutrition and health programs for children are under an extraordinary array of administrative auspices. Under that kind of array, they're not only wasteful, but you can't keep track of which child can benefit from which services. And I would argue that for all of these kinds of services, the public school may serve as a locale for a variety of these services. That is, the building may serve as a spot from which the services will be delivered. But the public school building, public school people themselves, ought not to be the ones who are responsible for seeing to it that all these services are coordinated. That ought to be able to be handled by a coordinating group. Third point I'd make about the president and education is that the president needs to recognize, as I'm sure he does, that the bulk of educational services that the federal government delivers are delivered outside of the Department of Education. And therefore, if you want to have a coherent federal education program, you've got to figure out how to coordinate those educational services that are currently being delivered all over the federal government, of which only the minority are through the U.S. Department of Education. That means a kind of cooperation between OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, and the Congressional Education and Authorization Appropriation Committees to give a little more coherence. For example, the improvement in the teaching of learning of different academic subjects is based not in the Department of Education, but in the National Science Foundation with $171 million for science education, in the National Endowment of Education's Education Division for English and Foreign Languages, $16 million. Look at how we lump all of English language instruction and all foreign language and history instruction together with a budget of $16 million, while science education gets $171. There we are. While the arts gets $5.6 in the National Endowment for the Arts. Secondly, general work in cognition, motivation, and pedagogy undertaken by the Department of Defense research groups for use with the military has broad applications both to school children and adult learners. The Department of Defense basic research budget is over $1 billion, of which half goes for university programs, vastly larger than the Department of Education's research budget. The Navy, for example, spends for literacy training alone, the United States Navy spends just on literacy training, $19.6 billion, which is almost the same amount that the federal government's educational research budget in the Department of Education. Third, for general work in learning, learning, language acquisition, learning disabilities, family influences, all of which are supported through the Department of Health and Human Services, its various institutes, such as the National Institute of Childhood Health and Human Development, all these contribute to understanding and the potential improvement of education. Those are all in Health and Human Services. Their budget's about $400 million a year. Finally, for programs of education and training that are focused on employment, summer youth programs, Job Corps, Job Training Partnership Act, for example, these are all in the Department of Labor. The total budget for those is $1.4 billion. The one program that we know about of these that is perhaps most effective of all, the Job Training Partnership Act, serves only 5% of the eligibles. That's in the Labor Department. It's as if the ones that are most effective are the ones that are serving the smallest fraction. So this argument then is a plea for coherence and coordination of the various parts of the federal government that deal with educational questions before you get to the fourth point, which has to do with the Department of Education's role. Now, what about, I mean, everything I've been talking about so far hasn't been in what is called the Department of Education. The Department of Education's current budget is just about $22 billion. Now, That's an interesting figure, because the estimate is that American business today annually spends about $23 billion, $1 billion more, for remediation of newly employed workers. Now, there's something strange in this country. If the federal government's education budget is less than what American business spends annually in remedial activities for new employees, something is not functioning somewhere. So I would argue that the Department of Education, as the most visible federal agency, is nonetheless extraordinarily limited in its ability to coordinate these kinds of activities. But I don't want to give up on the Department of Education, so I got a little scheme for the Department of Education. I'll conclude with this. I believe, first of all, that the Department of Education should provide ancillary support for the president's bully pulpit, endorsing the improvement of both education in general and schooling in particular. Now, as my colleagues in the education world, most of us, I think, would have thought that Ted Bell, when he was appointed the Secretary of Education, was the most unlikely person most of us could think of to galvanize Americans about problems in American education. Yet it was Ted Bell, as Secretary of Education, who ginned up Commission on Excellence, and which gave us A Nation at Risk, which did capture the public imagination. So just when you're about ready to write off the ability of the Department of Education to make any difference, one needs to remember that kind of thing. But then I've got some specific projects for the Department of Education to think about. It seems to me that one is that the federal regulatory burden, the burden of having precise regulations that are intended to improve quality, but in fact prescribe behavior, we need to rethink that. I'm all for accountability. I think accountability is very important. But the fact of the matter is that if we and nobody else knows how to raise the level of the bottom third of the school population, and we all agree that their level ought to be raised, but if we don't know how to do it, it flies in the face of reality to prescribe in great detail how this is to be done. Let's say raise it. Hold them accountable for raising it, but let's not prescribe in the kind of minute detail that is currently prescribed in federal and state regulations how this is to be done. Now, most people, I mean, if I were running a school and I was getting money from the Department of Health and Human Services for this, and the Department of Labor for this, and this part of the Department of Education for this, and this part of the Department of Education for that, and I had to keep track of all those little different pots of money and follow each of the little rules that came with each of these, I would completely lose track of the child. I mean, what I got in my school is 500 kids who need help. And I got all these pieces of money that only can be spent in highly specific ways, in carefully regulated ways. Now, if I want to improve the circumstances for those 500 kids, I need some flexibility in how I can put this money together that will benefit these kids. Now, I also need, as the principal, to be held accountable to see after 3 years if, in fact, the children in my school are better off than they were before. But that kind of notion of holding people accountable for an achieved goal at the end, but not prescribing the way that they need to do that, that, I'm sorry to say, is foreign to the regulatory mode of the current federal government. Next, I would argue that we need to expand support for the one Department of Education program that is clearly working, and that is the old Title I program, now called Chapter I, which provides services for children, concentrations of children from low-income families and schools to provide additional support for them. This program, like Head Start, has never been adequately funded either. It's somewhere between 30 or 40% of the eligibles are being served. I'm enough of a serious researcher not to make wild claims, but therefore you have to be careful about causation issues. I would just observe the following facts. Head Start and Title I have traditionally been focused on little children. That is, children who are under the age of 6 or children who are ages 6 to 10. Now, in all these reports about how badly American school children are doing on tests, the one group that has persistently gone up are the little children. The children, the people who are doing badly are the high school people. The federal funds in Head Start and in Title I have been focused on the little children. The group which has consistently made the greatest gains, not the highest score, but proportionally the greatest gains, are black boys of the age of 9 in the Southeast. Now, black boys the age of 9 in the Southeast had a long way to go in learning how to read. But these are the ones who have been making progress. These are the ones on whom these programs have been targeted. Now, I'm at pains to say that we don't have the methodological sophistication to prove that they have made those gains because of these programs. But it does seem plausible that where the programs have been concentrated, gains have been made. There have been no comprehensive federal programs at the high school level, except for vocational education, which nobody's ever claimed was a success, except the voc ed educators. And where there have been no programs, scores have been steadily going down. So you can't make a straight causation argument, but I just point out those two facts. Next, I would say that we should restore the cuts in the educational research budget. If you're running a company, and your company is in trouble doing what you want the company to do, you normally do not cut your investment in research and development. Yet that is precisely what we have done in the federal education budget. In the last decade, in constant dollars, the budget for educational research at the federal level has been cut by 80%. There is no other part of the federal budget with which I am acquainted that has taken those kinds of cuts. Now, what is most important about that is that the federal government has been the prime funder of educational research. It is not the prime funder of operating schools, but it is the prime funder of educational research. So that when the federal budget for educational research gets cut by 80%, there is nobody else who is picking that up. The large foundations that used to fund educational research, like Ford Foundation, for example, and Carnegie Corporation, do not do that now. They have other interests on the whole. So you are eliminating your seed corn just at the moment you need to plant. And that does seem to be very short-sighted. So my final suggestion for the Department of Education, knowing that they have some of these kinds of financial problems, is to create some model programs that will go back and reinforce the president's bully pulpit. Some things that the president can say, we here in the government are really creating some model programs, which if they work, other people can pick up and extend. And let me just conclude with some model programs. ISU. By the end of the century, the estimates are that between 30 and 40% of the school children in the United States will be minorities. Yet the current percent of minority teachers is less than 10% and dropping rapidly. Remedy. Scholarships for minorities in one-year teacher education programs who enter public school teaching for periods of no less than 3 years. $500 a year at $10,000 per student would be $5 million. Issue B. Current estimates suggest that approximately half of the present teachers in public schools will retire or quit by the end of this century, thus creating an acute teacher shortage. Remedy. Scholarships for students in one-year teacher education programs who enter public school teaching for periods of no less than 3 years, $1,000 per year, $10,000 per student, $10,000. We'll point out that that will take care of any student in a public institution, will not take care of students in private institutions. It's federal policy, I think that's okay. C, and I'm at a private institution, I'm sorry to say, for this proposal. Issue. Most experienced teachers and administrators have no funded opportunities for additional study once they have completed their certification. Yet those in difficult or poor schools have particular need for such professional revitalization provided by full-time study. What most of them do now is quit. But if they're good, we'd like them to stay. And we'd like them to have a little revitalization so they can stay. Remedy. Sabbaticals for graduate study in their fields for teachers and administrators in schools either with predominantly poor student bodies or in schools below the state average per pupil expenditure. Teachers in well-to-do districts do have sabbaticals. It's these other teachers who don't. $500 per year, $25,000 per year, $12,500,000. Issue. Many large school systems are currently considering implementing something which they call school site management. Anyone here can tell me what school site management is. They got the golden apple. Nobody knows what school site management is, yet everybody says the solution to the big city school problems is school site management.
not top-down administration from the school superintendent's office, but school site management, let the school people manage their own destinies. Well, that's fine if you had people who knew how to manage their own destinies. But the difficulty is that the people who have gotten to be school principals have gotten there by following the rules, reading the regulations, and how are you going to get them to change their behavior and to change their vision of how to manage just by saying, now, boys, we believe in school site management. Remedy. Sabbatical for full-time study for such prospective school site managers, $250 per year, $25,000 per year, $6,250,000. And remedy two, summer fellowships for such prospective school site managers and programs addressing such management issues, $1,000 per year, $5,000 per summer, $5 million. Now, what do these new remedies cost, these ones I just talked about here? Well, they cost $38,750,000. One single B-2 stealth bomber cost $515,000. Thus, all these remedies are 1/20th the cost of one B-2 stealth bomber, and the Air Force wants 132 of them. I think it might be wise to spend this on education. Let me stop there.
Any questions from the left flank?
This is not an ideological statement, I trust.
your profession, Dick, or anybody?
Yeah, I would be interested in a little bit more about the role of the states and the localities in the accountability theme that you were pushing at.
Well, as we know, the states have been key actors in the educational skirmishes of the last 5 to 7 years. And the accountability measures that, on the whole, the states have used have been legislatively inspired. And they have been quite narrow in the kinds of accountability tools they've used. The essence, as you know, are students' performance on objective tests. And some of the states are thinking of more interesting means, that is, using bands for schools which and youngsters are of similar demographic characteristics. But I guess while I think that accountability is very important, I'm not very satisfied with the kinds of assessment instruments that we have now. I'm quite interested in what Richard Mills in Vermont, the Commissioner of Education in Vermont, is trying to do with portfolios as an alternative to simply standardized tests. I know that the Educational Testing Service is putting a lot of its resources at the present time into something which will transcend the paper and pencil tests of the kind in which they have made their fortune. I notice in today's paper that MCAT, the the application, the test that you take if you want to be a medical student, which used to be a simple test of, not simple, but it was a paper and pencil test of how much you knew about basic science, that the MCAT is now being completely revised, including an essay dimension, which they think they can now machine score. And the head of the Association of American Medical Colleges says this is because we realize there's more to being a doctor than knowledge of good science. Important insight for any of us who's ever been sick. We don't want a doctor who doesn't know science, but most of us would like a doctor who has a little more skill than just simply knowledge of biochemistry, since most of us think of ourselves a little more complex than a biochemical unit. So I'm encouraged about the opportunity to move to a broader range of assessment issues from what has been done. I've got another speech which I'm going to give you today, but it's the 4A speech, which says that in the United States we have been interested in education historically in 4 A's. Access, can people get in? Attendance, will they stay? Achievement, might they actually learn something? And assessment, what have they really learned?
Well, would the Department of Education hold the states accountable for the for their performance on dimensions like this? Or how do you see the federal role?
I would say the federal role in this kind of thing would be
heavily in developing new kinds of assessment instruments and model programs in which portfolios and new kinds of assessment instruments could be tried out.
The research and development phase.
That's right. And also, see, I think that, I mean, I don't know how many of you have ever been happy or the unhappy recipient of a federal audit. And generally speaking, it's not a great experience. I would say that as districts are, when compliance by districts is sought, that the kinds of evidence of compliance that we've usually seen is heavily paper and pencil based. And my argument would be that we ought to get a team of people who use qualitative methodologies as well as quantitative methodologies to go into a district and see not just is their paper trail satisfactory, have they pulled out all those Title I kids so they can keep track of them separately, but reach a more consensual and qualitative judgment about whether or not these schools are really providing places in which children do learn, as opposed to places in which children score at some point on some standardized reading test. So it would seem to me the federal government's role would be to investigate new ways of doing them and try out some of those new kinds of ways, both of assessment and of new automation. One of the most positive things I've said about the federal government is that I used to think that the GAO, the General Accounting Office, is a bunch of people, retirees from Arthur Andersen or Coopers and Lybrand. Turns out that's not what the GAO is like at all anymore. Some of the most interesting work in the federal government and qualitative assessment is going on in the GAO. And that's, I think, a very positive sign.
Anything more, Dennings or others? Oh, God, boy, I'm curious about the new president who's proclaimed himself already to be the education president, and wonder if you have a perception that he might be open to any or all these ideas.
Well, Dennings, I'm the wrong team.
Well, I understand.
My guess is that with this president, as with most other presidents, there will be a great deal of rhetoric about education and how important it is, but you got to get a Secretary of Defense first, and then you got to get your other appointees in after that, and then you got to figure out some other pressing problem, and you never get to your third priority, which is education. But I hope I'm mistaken about that.
I wonder, and you spoke of the difficulties of coordination among the departments in the national government and the fragmentation of the education laws or laws relating to education.
And as you know well.
I wonder if you could comment on whether this is really traceable to the conflict between the White House and Congress, and whether the movement toward a greater integration of programs is something that is really accomplishable by the executive branch without some modification of congressional committee structures and ways of operating.
Certainly, I think that modification of the congressional... Oh, excuse me.
I have another question, too. Not quite related.
Certainly, I think that closer alignment between the congressional committee structure and the executive branch would be helpful. But I guess I would argue that the executive branch has brought some of this on itself. The Department of Education, of course, contributed, the creation of the Department of Education, of course, contributed to these problems. It used to be that Head Start and Title I were in the same department at HEW. They're not anymore. Now, there are many, many, many criticisms that can and have been made about how HEW was managed. But at least in HEW, you had the possibility within the executive branch of having a more coherent look at children and their developmental needs and their health needs. Secondly, in HEW, you also had a much clearer understanding of research. Research in the Department of Education is seen as an absolutely ununderstandable by any person who is senior in the department, because everybody who's senior in the department understands that the federal government's role in education is not to assume primacy over states and locals. And so the people who come to senior level positions in the department all have that mindset. They do not
have any understanding that the federal government's role in educational research is primary, not secondary. And furthermore, they have no connection with how research is done. In HEW, there, at the senior level of the department, since you had the National Institutes of Health and the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, there was a deep understanding of how research was done and how and what the links, however ill-formed those links were, between research and practice. That is the creation of the department has the Department of Education has eliminated that possibility for coordination. Now, I'm certainly not arguing that you ought to go back to HEW. I mean, that waters over that bridge. But I would just say that the principal argument for me is not the difficulty between the executive branch and the Congress, because I think, in fact, that the coordination could better be achieved between the executive branch and the Congress than can be achieved thus far within the executive branch itself.
Sure,
and I think that the political basis in the current administration, with Democratic-controlled Congress and a Republican-controlled administration, creates an opportunity out of the difficulty for the Congress to take some initiative and try to bring the executive branch into some more coherent force.
The reason Edith Mosier deserves a follow-up is that, in spite of all that we do in talking about Frederick Mosier, well, the real expert on education in the government is Edith Mosier.
Please.
It's
gone beyond. I wondered if you care to comment on the tendency since the Department of Education was established to use it for satisfying campaign workers and for heavily politicizing the appointment process for the Department of Education. There are some other departments as well, but that's a criticism of the Department of Education that has been widely circulated.
Because it's a low status department. It's not seen to be central to the operation of the federal government. And therefore, you can pay off the people that need to be paid off with appointments there. And that's the absolute antithesis of federal leadership in education.
Because maybe that's one of those things that needs to be added to that list.
You would have to get concerned about it first, wouldn't he?
Yes.
Yes. I was wondering, I have heard that the per capita expenditure in the District of Columbia is $5,000 per pupil, which is twice what we spend here in Charlottesville, and yet it's generally perceived that the schools in the district are probably the worst in the United States. And how do you see any connection between the money spent and the results obtained?
None.
My friend, the principal of the South Boston High School, which is a high school that serves entirely poor kids, and the teachers are always saying when they get transferred from a school where they got the teaching children of lawyers and doctors and so on, they got transferred to South Boston and they're appalled at the circumstances of the children. The principal says to the teachers, he said, you know, the parents send us the best children they have. I think that our educational system in the United States and most other places has been based on the fact that the parents of the successful child in school play a very considerable role in helping that child succeed in school. And the child, if the child is nurtured at home and in the community, the church, the synagogue, the Girl Scouts, the Boy Scouts, Outward Bound, whatever your favorite outfits are, all those things help the child to do well in school. What happens in the District of Columbia and most other cities, and I think the D.C. public schools have got some real competition for the whole position, is that those children, through no fault of their own, were born into circumstances which had not been as nourishing of their subsequent educational development. And you know, how can you blame a six-year-old who came into this life at less than 2 pounds, was therefore in an institution at great public expense for 3 to 4 months, correcting birth defects because the kid is a fetus did not get the support he had, into a home which is below the poverty level, into a neighborhood in which proprieties are not observed, in which we take Washington seriously these days, which is very unsafe. How can you expect that child entering school to be able to be on a level playing field with our children? That didn't help with our children.
The money spent, though, apparently didn't help. We spent double the money and didn't really get.
Oh, but sir, the issue in a child and in nurturing a child is not just money. I mean, you have children?
They all do.
I mean, would you rather have had double the money spent and you and your family withdraw from those children?
I wouldn't have wanted to go to school in Washington.
Well, you see, you're fortunate enough you didn't have to.
I was a hoodie, but you were too.
You know, it's interesting that there's a wonderful study of reading of the Indiana school children. The Indiana school children are reading better now than they were when we were. So that's a good sign.
Helen Hamilton.
In relating just to that specific point, the Hispanic and Asian children now are a large majority of the minority. What should the role be of the president's bully pulpit to improve the skills, the educational skills of the Hispanics and the Asians in particular?
Well, I think one needs to separate that problem out by what kinds of Hispanics we're talking about and what kinds of Asians we're talking about. Because the Cuban Hispanics are a very different kettle of fish than the Puerto Rican Hispanics or the Chicanos, the ones from Mexico. The Cuban, who are a significant fraction of the Hispanics in the United States, have generally done quite well. Some of the other Hispanics groups have not. So I guess I would be interested in thinking about that question. And certainly if you look at the University of California, Berkeley, and you look at their undergraduate student body, would observe that some Asian children are doing very well in this country.
Those are the older children, these little bitty.
Some of the little bitty ones are doing, seem to be doing all right too. So there's just, I think there's a great variety, is what I'm trying to say. And that it's, and I'm probably guilty of talking about minorities and confusing the issue by not being as clear about these different groups. But I guess I've got a little fashion. I think that children need to grow up in an environment in which they are cherished and in which people take them seriously. And then when they get into the school system has to believe in their educability. See, most of our children, when they went to schools, the school believed that our children could be educated. We tend to believe that Asian children can be educated. We think of all those little bright winners of the Westinghouse Science Fair who are Oriental. We don't tend to think that Hispanics who don't have a good grip on English or blacks from poor families, we don't seem to think they can be educated. And that level of expectation is just terribly important. So I'm very big on seeing some success stories. I suppose that probably that ridiculous, that inspirational, but not entirely accurate movie, Stand and Deliver, has done more for the educability of Hispanic youngsters than many other activities. I think they need to get a good grip on English. It'll be the last thing I'll say.
Mrs. Owen, and then Dr. Alder.
What is your evaluation of Mrs. Bush's interest in reading and illiteracy?
I'm delighted she has.
Yes. I mean, do you think that it's going to be a very strong thrust to help the reading problems that are apparently that these 5% of our youngsters were never addressed, like dyslexia?
I hope so.
Well, you don't sound very
good. No, I think that's because I haven't seen yet the kind of program that needs to come from it. I mean, if we're going to talk about literacy problems in America, particularly adult illiteracy, it seems to me we need to make a number of distinctions. One is, are we talking about a lack of literacy in English for people who are native speakers of English, or lack of literacy in English
for people who are not native speakers of English. We're talking about people who have been thoroughly educated in a school system, thoroughly meaning that they've been there for a long time and for whom it hasn't taken. Or we're talking about people who were deprived of opportunities for formal education. Most of what I have read and have learned from my colleagues, some of Gene Troll and Denny Wolf and Catherine Snow, who are working on these issues, is that, I think that's implied in the question, is that a significant portion of the American adult illiterate group are a group who have some particular difficulty with learning to read, to acquire language fluency. Because most of them can pick out individual words, but getting genuine fluency of the sort you need to function effectively today is difficult for them. It seems to me that if they have significant difficulties in learning, we are not likely to be able to help them get over this barrier with untrained volunteers, however good-hearted the volunteer is. That means that that to run a first-class adult illiteracy program, we gotta have people who not only are good-hearted, but who are also knowledgeable about the kinds of common problems that individuals encounter in dealing with the symbol system of language. And most of the discussion about adult illiteracy that I've heard so far has not taken too seriously the fact that the reason these adults have not learned to read is not because they haven't been taught in the past, but because they have some particular kind of impairment that needs to be overcome. And the volunteer, who is part-time, is not likely to be knowledgeable about how to help them overcome that impairment.
I agree with you there, and I think that's been brought out, that they have not had too much success because they haven't had the training, and it's so much harder to deal with it when they're older. But what about the testing of the babies, the 4 and 5 year olds, when they get started? Learning different ways of learning.
Well, I have a colleague who's very interested in this, a colleague named Howard Gardner, who with another fellow at Tufts had been working on this in something called Project Spectrum. And their point of view is that all children, little children, need a very rich environment of manipulable objects and not only a safe and secure and loving environment, but one that's also rich in objects. They don't have to be expensive objects. You know, they don't have to be play school toys, but they do need to be the old Montessori notion that we need to have a lot of objects. Montessori thought they had to be particular kinds. These folks are more eclectic in their approach. They also think that you can make some very interesting assessments of young children. And we know that the child with low birth weight who is inadequately nourished is going to have a higher incidence of these kinds of subsequent difficulties than others, and those are the children who presently are not well served in these kinds of programs. You know, when it's for our children, we call it nursery school. When it's their children, we call it daycare. And the nursery schools provide this kind of environment. The daycare, the varieties of daycare typically do not. If you could intervene with these children, identify those who need some special attention and whose various intelligences can be nurtured at an early age, you know, it's just like when you begin to get the sniffles, if you take vitamin C and go to bed and have an aspirin and some orange juice, you get over it. If you wait until you got double pneumonia, it's a lot tougher to get over the difficulty. And with our children, many of these children, we don't get them in the sniffle stage, we get them in the double pneumonia stage, when it is very much more difficult.
That's
to,
where the Head Start.
Yeah, where the Head Start, where the daycare, where the enriched programs in the primary school, the school building that delivers a variety of these kinds of services at the building level, that opens at 7 o'clock in the morning and remains open until 7:30 in the evening. See, those would not have a teacher there all that time, but staffed by various people seems to me to be highly desirable. That's why you reduce the adult illiteracy at the end.
You mentioned that how important it is, I certainly agree, for high school kids to stay home and do their homework and not work at fast food shops. But staying home and doing homework is based on long-term goals, which are typically middle-class reasons for educating. If you study now, you'll be a doctor 20 years from now. And short-term goals are the theme of not only the children but the parents in the lower third. They've been disillusioned about mm-hmm. long-term goals.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it time that someone needs to pick up on Israel Goldiamond's idea a long time ago that you need to pay children for study in the lower third, and perhaps even pay the parents for providing the kind of atmosphere that will assist the children to pay?
Well, that's what the Atlanta Public Schools have been doing. And whether, you know, I'll be careful again about causation versus correlation, but certainly scores have improved in the Atlanta Public Schools. Now, it's not clear to me that it's just because the kids have been being paid to do the homework, but the Atlanta Public Schools is the example, best example I know of a school system that has a high concentration of low-income children that has tried this out.
So should the federal government
Well, see, I'm not into prescribing solutions. I'm into saying what we want is these kids to do a whole lot better than they are now. And I really am, you know, maybe it's my Hoosier origins or whatever they are, but I really have enormous belief in the capacity and ingenuity of the American people in local communities to dream up good solutions. But everybody's got to be clear about what the outcome is. And frankly, in this country, we haven't cared a whole lot if the bottom third didn't get educated in the past. What's really new about the present educational reform movement is that we're now worried about the bottom third, either because we're worried about somebody being working to pay our Social Security, or because of a latent sense of social justice, or because we don't like the competition with Japanese, or whatever it is. But we've never really been concerned that the bottom third get educated before. This is a new development. And therefore, we don't have a good idea how to do it for those people whom we haven't done it for in the past or with in the past. So I think, you know, we need to let the federal government fund several model programs. One of them may be the pay them to do the homework program. Some other community might think up another program. I'm not quite in the thousand flowers bloom mold because I want them all to be achieving at the end, but I think we make a mistake when we expect the federal government to tell us the way to solve a problem. We gotta figure out how to solve the problem. Federal government has to tell us there's a problem that's gotta be solved. And the role of the federal government is to keep the heat on about what the nature of the problem is and the requirement that it be solved.
Mr. Thurman?
Aren't some of the states initiating 4-year-olds at risk,
absolutely,
bringing them into
absolutely
the school system
mm-hmm
for the
absolutely
purpose of identifying these problems?
Absolutely. That's a good idea.
I think they were having meetings in Richmond this last year in regard
yeah
to that. Even in bringing in church school programs
absolutely
and
absolutely
funding them
yeah
through the state.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a great idea. I mean, I'm not arguing that you need to get the big public monolith in on all this. I mean, it seems to me that the opportunity for the Methodists, the Baptists, the Presbyterians to coordinate has been a little difficult in the past, but it's conceivable we might even make it this time. And including using public funds for daycare programs that are run in church facilities.
Sure, yeah.
You have a position on teaching children with Spanish background or Native Americans in the first 3 years in their foreign language, in their native language?
Nope. I don't have a position on that. I have, however, some positions on subjects related to that. One is that the old style method of immersing children in English, as happened when my father entered the public school of the United States, couldn't speak a word of English. And he had been taught one phrase, which he was told he was supposed to use whenever he was called on. So the teacher on the first day called him and pointed her finger at him, and he said, "My name is Victor Lincoln Alger." That turned out not to be the answer to the question. The entire class hooted. He felt terrible and didn't go to school for 2 weeks, allegedly. So that the old method of dropping a youngster who didn't speak English in the public schools and just assuming that somehow or other they would all figure it out does not seem to me to have been eminently successful. My father was one of nine. My father ended up writing an autobiography published in his hometown newspaper in Denmark about attributing his success as an American to the American public school system. The assumption was that his eight brothers and sisters all benefited similarly. Well, the rest of them didn't finish the eighth grade. But he wrote the autobiography, so we all think that, you know, in the old days it all worked perfectly. I don't think that the state of research knowledge exists that can prescribe what is the best method of language instruction for all children. Some children may benefit from one thing, some children may benefit from another thing. It seems to me there are two principles that need to be maintained. The first is that the child have confidence in his heritage, whatever his heritage may be, whether it's Spanish or Lithuanian or Danish or whatever it is. The child has to think that where they come from is a good thing, and that's a good thing. Secondly, you live in this country, you've got to be fluent in English. I think it's just to say that a child doesn't need to be fluent in English is just nuts. A child in this country needs to become fluent in English. I've read a fair amount of research on what's sometimes called bilingual education, and English is second language. And people are always looking for the universal solution to this problem. Well, it strikes me that children whose native language is not English are not a unitary entity. Some will learn English one way, some will learn English another way, some will do it another way. And I would like to see a variety of approaches tried. Some people think that the transition method is right. Some think that you ought to keep them in their native language until they acquire literacy in their native language. It's not clear to me that there is a perfect solution, but the two principles do seem to me to be very important. Namely, they have confidence in their heritage and belief in their heritage, and secondly, that they develop fluency in English. And how you implement that, probably not going to be a single way, probably a variety of ways.
I keep wondering whether we know all that there is to be known about what has been attempted in this field. George Shultz is grumpy right now because he said James Baker hadn't asked him a single question about foreign policy. But for 10 years, my vice presidency at Rockefeller was one of the areas that I supervised was equal opportunity. And in the beginning, I supervised it and implemented it both because we had so little. But we did a lot of things, and some of them, it seemed to me, worked, like a program of putting black minority principals and teachers into the offices of big city superintendents.
Right. That certainly did. And a lot you of see people, those people around now in leadership right. positions.
Well, we did a lot of other things, like giving comic books, helping Locke High School and Watts buy comic books for students because it was said they just couldn't read other things. We did storefront schools, we did gangs, we did all kinds of things. And we tried to evaluate them a little bit, but I've never known what happened after I left, and nobody, for the time when I was a resource, I think literally nobody ever asked me a question of what did I think had happened within any of these programs.
What do you think happened in those programs?
How much time do you have? Some of them worked, some of them were disasters.
Could you predict now which ones would work and which ones would not?
No.
What you need is more research.
But I'm the point is, and you've made the same point about localities, that there must be a lot out there that is done, that is being researched up to a point by institutions like yours and by some government groups. But I wonder if one further reason for R&D is that we don't know what we know we
do. Absolutely. That's absolutely right. I also think we haven't cared. And I see, I think that's a very big issue. I mean, there's, I work at the Harvard Graduate School of Education in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We charge an arm and a leg for tuition to go to school there. Next year it's going to be $12,000. That's a terrible amount of money. And I can tell you we're not making money on the side on that either. I might add that it's significantly less than a number of other places. It's less than Stanford, it's less than Chicago, it's less than several other private institutions. But yet, if we want to recruit to our place people who are in the public school world who are going to assume positions of leadership in public education, it's very hard to do that. If these people have had 5 or 6 years of teaching experience or administrative experience, you know, they're nearing their 30s, they're making maybe 35, they're administrators, they're making $35,000 or $40,000, they've got a couple of kids. How do you get them to come? Particularly, how do you get minorities to come? Because it's clear that you need more minorities in teaching and administration. So we have some very distinguished alumni. Some of those distinguished alumni are minorities. And they have particularly seen more minorities come. The story that they invariably tell me is that when they were graduate students in the late 60s, they went down to Rockefeller and they went to other foundations, and those foundations provided fellowship money for those minority students to go. Now, I've been dean of this place 8 years, and I've made a lot of calls. And I can name on the fingers of both hands, toes, and then I can start in on yours, the number of people who have said, oh yes, we're very concerned about public education, but we really don't think minority fellowships in education are important. We're more interested in computers, or we're more interested in something else. Well, what that tells me is that the leadership the philanthropic and business and government communities in this country really isn't concerned about these matters. They were concerned in the 60s. They have not been concerned in the last decade. And if there's a statement that I think is important, is that we all need to be concerned about improving the quality of our schools, particularly for those children whose parents, for whatever reason, are not effective spokespersons for them.
I think we've probably reached our limit. If any of you have questions you'd like to ask, and I know that Professor Fernbach does, why, maybe we can ask them privately after the session, but we do try to keep to a timetable. Walter Lippmann used to write about these subjects in the 60s, and he was no flaming liberal by then, but he used to quote some very interesting statistics about the lower third. And it's fortunate, it seems to me, that a handful of people maybe, but a very significant handful, like Dean Graham, are raising the same kinds of issues that he tried to raise in his time. Maybe we, through her efforts and those of others, will begin to turn to what ought to be our most urgent area of concentration, I suspect, in education. Thank you very much.